Hi, this is Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out the podcast of Connecting Faith. Programs like this are made possible through the financial support of listeners like you. You can find out more or make a gift by clicking on the Support Faith Radio tab on the homepage. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Neil Stavem. I always love getting together each weekday here on the program. I hope you enjoy it as well. We always have a good time. My producer, newly into the chair, Ryan Nisley, welcome
Hello.
Back. Yeah, day two.
Good
I
to
just
be here.
If this was a sense around program, then people would be able to experience the rich aroma that I have on my hands right now. Apparently, Susie Larson has a little bottle of hand cream here
yes.
in the studios. And I thought, you know, it's the time of year, you know, upper Midwest, you just get dry. So
yeah.
It's midnight pomegranate.
There's a certain pungency to the odor that is affecting us all in a very deep way right
wow.
now.
Wow. I'm sure my guest today, she will understand that and probably affirm that. But I'm just, midnight pomegranate normally is not my fragrance of choice. I think I'll just say that.
Well, I don't know what the difference between a pomegranate at midnight and noon would be. But
apparently it's much more pungent. That's my guess.
We're learning.
Anyways, we're happy to Ryan, to kind of put you on the spot today, because you being a fine young man of, I was going to say marriageable age, I suppose, and we put that on. But we're going to talk today. Here, you know, Valentine's coming up in a couple of days. That wasn't really our original intent on today's show, but as we looked at booking our guests, I thought, you know, she has done a wonderful work on cultivating realistic, positive expectations for Christian marriage. So thinking that this would be an opportunity for you, Ryan, to just learn a great deal.
Well, this is very important for me because I'm ready to learn. I'm ready
okay.
to absorb
sure.
whatever
right.
wisdom she may have.
Well, we may have a little quiz toward the end of the show, just see how you did. But let me introduce my guest today, because I'm really excited to have her back on the program with us. What we're eventually going to get to is a wonderful book that she's written called Keeping House, The Litany of Everyday Life. And it just seemed like here in the middle of February is a good time to kind of talk about that as well, those kind of everyday chores. Margaret Kim Peterson is, she served as an associate professor of theology at Eastern University in St. David's, Pennsylvania. She's authored several works, including Sing Me to Heaven, Keeping House. Also wrote a chapter for Women Ministering the Gospel from University Press. And her husband Dwight wrote a book out here, I think it was a couple of years ago, called Are You Waiting for the One? Cultivating Realistic Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage. And as I recall, this kind of came out of opportunities that Margaret and Dwight had as they were just interacting with the students and young people, and realized that there's a lot of information out there that may not be all that biblical or helpful when it comes to romance and love stories and all that. So it comes out of a seminar that they have done in the past. And we're just happy to have Margaret back on the air with us. Margaret, how are you doing today?
I am doing just fine, and it's such a pleasure to hear your voice again and have the opportunity to talk.
Would you be wearing any midnight pomegranate hand lotion today at all? So.
I am not.
Okay.
But, you know, my husband gets after me from how dry my hands get and how little lotion I put on them. So if there were any around, he'd be pressing me to put it on.
Well, I would say you may smell the fragrance coming through the mic here eventually, but anyway. So. Let's talk a little bit about Are You Waiting for the One? Because this did kind of develop out of your just getting interaction with some of your students, right?
It did. Well, we ended up through kind of a series of unforeseen, unplanned events teaching a college class called Christian Marriage, and we were just, you know, we set it up at the beginning so that we could listen to our students at least as much as we talked to them, because we thought, you know, people talk about generation gaps, and we are a generation older than our students, and we shouldn't just assume that we know what the issues are, or that we know what the questions are, or what the challenges are. So we listened a lot to our students, and, you know, we were really struck by how much Our students wanted to have healthy, mature relationships, especially dating relationships and moving toward healthy marriage relationships, but also how little opportunity they had often to talk with people who were older than themselves, perhaps had some wisdom of experience. You know, the books that they would turn to were often written also by very young people, very earnest young people, but young people without the benefit of perhaps as much perspective as might be nice. And so we ended up writing a book ourselves after we'd been teaching the class for 8 or 10 years and trying to address the kinds of issues that we saw coming up and in a way that was biblical and, you know, Christianly reflective and helpful.
The idea, of course, waiting for the one is that there's that one perfect soulmate out there. And I guess that from your perspective, is this a belief or tradition or expectation? Is it based on our understanding of God's will and his sovereignty, or where did this kind of develop?
Well, we think it's kind of a combination of Madison Avenue, where if you shop long enough, you can have exactly what you want, and Walt Disney, where the story ends with the prince and the princess getting together, rather than beginning at that point. And we think it's kind of unfortunate that an awful lot of Christians seem to think that that's what God wants for us, rather than kind of digging a little deeper and looking perhaps into Christian tradition and longer human practices of, you know, what marriage has been about. You know, it's been about forming a new household, joining two families, creating a stable context for rearing children, for mutual emotional support, for, you know, a whole range of things. But kind of the fairy tale romance where there's only one and, you know, you see each other across a crowded room and bells ring. There are an awful lot of Christian books who say, yeah, if you'll entrust your love life to God, that's what he'll give you. And I guess we wanted to say to our students, let's think about A, what does it mean to trust your love life to God? And B, what would an answer to prayer look like? What would the fulfillment of kind of genuinely Christian hopes for marriage look like?
So this is more of a Christian little Christian overlay on the cultural design, right?
Well, that's what we think we see too frequently. And yet, I think there is really a deep hunger in young people for something really substantial. And, you know, we have heard numerous people say, you know, my mom's been buying me all these books because she really wants me happy and she wants me married and she wants grandchildren. You know, I read them and they just kind of, they don't really do a whole lot for me, and I feel like a failure because I haven't found that special person and I don't feel at peace with singleness, and what do I do? And so we've really wanted to take those concerns and questions seriously and offer something substantive, something helpful, something hopeful that says you can do it, and let's think about what that might look like.
Let's talk about, just as we explained, maybe the concept, I mean, it's pretty clear, I think, what we're talking about. But so what are some of the problems or maybe challenges with pursuing a mate with this kind of frame of reference?
Well, one of the problems, I think, is that it kind of isolates the search from a mate from a lot of the rest of your life. The thought is that that one special person is, you know, it's so unique, there's really no parallels anywhere else. And we want to say, look at who you are as a human being. Look at how you're maturing into manhood or womanhood from adolescence. Look at your family, at what your family's stories are. It's what happened with your parents and your grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins and brothers and sisters. These are important people in your lives, and getting an understanding, kind of a nuanced, truthful, charitable understanding of the story that you've been living in your family, this can help you to step into adulthood and into things like marriage in a way that will be rewarding and will carry with it the possibility of really setting down deep roots and finding a lot of satisfaction in marriage. And so I guess, you know, we want to link marriage and the choice of a mate and a decision whether or not to marry and decisions about how to go about building a marriage. We want to link that to the rest of people's lives rather than have it be this kind of isolated, fairy tale romance that kind of comes out of nowhere and the person comes out of nowhere and all of a sudden everything is, you know, beautiful and perfect, whereas it hasn't been before.
Well, just the fact that you said that there's really no parallels, then we just assume that this is, there's no, I guess, what, no precedence, nothing that we can, you know, balance this around or put any framework around it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And You know, I was reading another book, not by a Christian author, but by a person who has worked with a lot of young people and you know, people in their 20s and moving into their 30s wanting stable marriages. And this person has encountered a lot of this, you know, like the uniqueness of the right person that you marry. And she says, look, you know, getting anything important right usually takes a few good tries. So, you know, you need to be thinking about relationships and about getting married and, you know, forming friendships before you're thinking, oh, I got to find the one. Because if you save it all up for later, you know, it's you know, you're going to be trying to put all your eggs in one basket, and it's probably not going to be helpful.
So what would a more balanced approach look like? I mean, maybe just flesh that out a little bit more. If we want to not just be putting all our eggs in one basket, how does that, I mean, maybe the trying process or at least just the mentality behind that work?
I think partly it means taking seriously your non-romantic relationships, both with family members. As I mean, think about who's thinking about wanting to get married. Well, mostly people who are relatively young adults. And so it wasn't so long ago that they were still children in the context of their families, and they didn't have the opportunity to talk with their folks and with their siblings and aunts and uncles and others in really adult ways about the family. We think that's a good thing, and that it's part of growing into a mature person who could step into a marriage and help create something that could work. So think hard about stepping into closer and more intimate and truthful relationship with members of your family, and with friends and with people at church, especially, you know, people of all different ages. You know, branch out. So that's one important thing. And then, you know, be open to getting to know people who maybe could be potential marriage partners without having to freight it all ahead of time, as in, like, I only date to marry, so prove to me that you'd be a good marriage partner before we know each other. We don't think that's really a very good idea. That you know, getting to know people and thinking, you know, how, you know, do I want to open up more to this person? Does this person want to open up more to me? What can we build together? And trying to, you know, bracket questions of, do we want to get married? You know, at least at the beginning. You know, when I think that there are a lot of Christians who, you know, they really want to save people from hurt. And, you know, goodness knows I don't want to see anybody hurt either. But I don't think the way to be hurt is not to have relationships that could be, you know, that we could call dating relationships or courting relationships until you're already sure that this is the right person. Because it gets the cart before the horse. How can you possibly decide whether you want to marry somebody until you know them reasonably well? So, you know, being open to relationship, exploring, taking the chance that maybe, you know, maybe your heart will be touched and maybe you'll open yourself to the possibility of hurt, but maybe you'll open yourself to the possibility of really deep intimacy that's built on something, that's built on really knowing and being known.
But isn't there, I mean, don't people say, well, you know, dating goes somewhere, so, you know, don't sort of start until you really, you know, that you're willing to kind of go down that road?
Well, yeah, I can't buy into that.
Okay.
I certainly understand the desire of Christian young people not to go down roads that are immoral or unwise or dangerous in that kind of way. But I think it's also important to say that relationship is inherently risky. You know, sitting down and having like a long talk with your mom about the family she grew up in, that's relationally risky. You know, I mean, what might she say? You know, maybe you'll find out mom is more complicated than you thought, and that there's some heartache there or some surprises, some unexpected things. You know, relationship is risky. And to be willing to open yourself to that with same-sex friends, perhaps, and maybe with opposite-sex friends, maybe somebody that eventually you could think about dating. I think that's important. You know, I think sometimes people use the word dating to mean the kind of activity that gets people in trouble.
Okay.
I don't think that's a helpful way to think about it. I think it's better to think about relationship and becoming a mature adult in relationship and seeing those relationships as part of the foundation you build for perhaps the relationship that might turn into marriage.
Margaret Kim Peterson is my guest, and we're talking about the book that she's written with her husband, Dwight, called Are You Waiting for the One? Cultivating Realistic, Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage. And in just a moment, we're going to talk a little bit about one of the chapters in their book. They talk about marriage. What makes it Christian? I'll ask Margaret that. We're going to move into one of her other books, talk a little bit about Keeping House, The Litany of Everyday Life, because marriage often That's a part of it. We're setting up a household, and we'll talk a little bit about the joys and challenges around those things as well. If you'd like to join us, you can give us a call. Be part of the program at 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. Or online, myfaithradio.com. You can click on the Connecting Faith show page. We'll continue in a minute. Well, we're 19 past the hour and talking today with Margaret Kim Peterson. Margaret serves as Associate Professor of Theology at Eastern University, St. David's, Pennsylvania, has written several books. The one that we're talking about, her and her husband Dwight co-wrote, called Are You Waiting for the One? Cultivating Realistic Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage. And it's a great resource, and they got some wonderful insights in it. Margaret, in one of the chapters you talk about marriage, what makes it Christian? Let me ask you, what makes a Christian marriage?
Well, in that chapter, one of the things we were trying to do was point to some resources in Christian tradition that suggest, you know, big themes that Christians have always thought of in terms of what marriage is about. And one of them is, I think in one of the old marriage liturgies, it talks about the restraining of sin. And what they mean is that marriage is, in God's economy, the human relationship where there is both sexual expectation and permission. That this is where sex is meant to be lived out in this lifelong promise between husband and wife. So that's one thing that marriage is for. Another thing that marriage is for in a traditionally Christian understanding is for the bearing and rearing of children. Children are seen as the fruit of marriage. It doesn't mean that you have to have children to be properly married. You know, when a couple first gets married and they don't have children yet, they're really married. And if children never come, they're really married. And yet, there's something about marriage and sex and children that goes together in an intrinsic, kind of God-intended kind of way in marriage. And so children are a blessing and properly seen as the fruit of marriage. And then a third thing that Christians have traditionally pointed to is the mutual help and comfort that spouses should have from one another. In other words, this is a place to find support and intimacy and accompaniment through everything that life brings. And this is where the liturgy will talk about for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. That this is a life companion. Hopefully not your only life companion. Hopefully you're surrounded by a church community and a family of origin or of choice, and you know, all sorts of other communities as well. But this is a special person to walk with you through everything that life has to offer. And so those are three traditional lenses for looking at what makes a marriage Christian, the joining of marriage, sex, and children, and then this lifelong companionship.
I think that maybe in our society today we haven't done so well at really helping singles develop real relationships, or maybe we've not had the right focus, I guess, on that. So that if we're not in a married state, that doesn't mean that you're a second class citizen or something like that.
Well, you know, one of the things that's happened just in the past several generations is the expectation that young people will grow up and leave home to go away to school, and then they will also move for jobs, for work. And so people are much more scattered now than they were a few generations ago. Children typically live a long distance from their parents. And under sociological conditions like that, it gets lonely. Right, you're not living in the community you grew up in. You're not living close to lots of your relatives, lots of your blood kin, and so I think people both want marriage, you know, especially under those circumstances. If you're living in a tightly knit traditional community, whether you're single or not isn't the only determinant of whether you have company in life, right? But if you've moved away, who's going to be with you? I think it also being geographically isolated and distant from family is something that makes it harder to be married well, because you've got fewer supports and fewer people to help you when times get hard one way or another. I think it's not clear to me what the best way is to help support people who are single. And that's lots of us, right? It's lots of people at lots of times in our lives. People get married later. They get they're widowed. Spouses die. Divorce often happens, including to people who didn't think it would ever happen to them. And so we spend, most of us, significant amounts of our adult lives single. And I don't think the church, and I count myself among this, among the number of the church, I don't think the church has really done an adequate job of figuring out how can we create a model of Christian adulthood that doesn't have being married right now be kind of an essential part of that. Yes, you can be married and be a fully adult member of a church. You can also be single. I don't see that really happening in a way that is substantive enough to feel really satisfying.
Well, and I know you, in the book you talk about kind of starting out young love, but to end up at old love as well. That, I mean, that, you know, we go through seasons in our relationship, and that we need to be cultivating relationship all the way along.
Well, we do. You know, when we first submitted this manuscript to the publisher, we had a chapter called Old Love, and they sent it back with a note saying, you've got to get rid of this chapter title, it's just too depressing. And we wrote back and said, absolutely not. You know, the point of young love is that it grows into old love. And that's not to say there's anything wrong with young love. Young love is great, and old love is great, too, that there are pleasures to beginnings and there are pleasures to maturity. And they're very different. And, you know, it takes time and shared experience to move into the pleasures of old love, having been around for each other for a long time and really knowing each other well and having learned how to navigate all of the kind of the challenges that have come along and inherited shared blessings together and, you know, looking at together at what you've made of your lives and regrets that you might have and satisfactions that you may have. You know, old love is a good thing, and it can burn, you know, just as hot, as if I can put it that way, as young love. It's different, but it's not less, and it's a good thing. It's a good thing to hope to grow into.
One of our callers asked this question. Talk about the intricacies of searching for a partner, especially within a Christian community, and then when, you know, when friends start to couple up and the pressure's on to follow suit.
Well, I think what I would say is take the time to get to know people. And don't limit yourself to getting to know people who might be potential marriage partners, but certainly don't shy away from getting to know people who might be potential marriage partners. Keep your mind open. You know, you don't know until you know people a little bit, at least. It's hard to know whether that person might be your type or not. I think we all have kind of an idea of what our type is like. I think of a friend of mine who said, oh, I always wanted to marry somebody who was tall, dark, and handsome, and then she laughed and she said, how he ended up being short and blonde. And you know, they've been married for, I don't know, 65 years now. Seems to have worked out. You know, I think we have preconceptions of who we might like based on things like appearance or common interests or whatever. I think of another young person who was a student in one of my classes who was very bookish, and she really wanted somebody else who would be bookish, and they could talk, you know, about books. And then she ended up with somebody who works with his hands and is a wonderful carpenter, fixes things, builds things, just a completely different kind of intelligence and personality that she has. And, you know, she had to let go of that and kind of mourn that hope for the partner who would love books with her at the same time as she opened to the possibility of a partner who could build things. And again, I think it's, you know, when we're looking for a partner, when we're thinking, I really would like to marry, who do I know who might be a potential person? Being open-minded, being willing to take the chance involved in getting to know somebody better. And, you know, maybe you'll get to know somebody better and you think, I'd love to have this person as a friend, but not as a marriage partner. And that could happen. And, you know, there's perhaps some loss there, but there's gain, too. So being open.
The old story about not, you know, looking for Mr. Right, but settling for Mr. Right now or something. But so how do you talked about that you used the phrase let go of the hope. Do we need to work on our
that just sounds so depressing. Well, I don't want people letting go of hope.
Yes, no.
there was a book that was published a few years ago called, it was something about marrying Mr. Good Enough.
Yes.
and the person who wrote this book was talking about how she felt like she'd held out for that perfect guy, and now she was of an age where she realized, A, she was old enough to realize there aren't perfect guys, and some of the people that she thought were not good enough were just, they weren't quite exciting in the way that she wanted somebody to be exciting, but she realized as she got older that exciting doesn't wear quite as well as steady and reliable and faithful and will be a good husband and provider and father to my children. And so I feel like, you know, there's a word my students use a lot is settling. They do not want to settle. And I really try to reframe that. You know, let's think about what really matters in somebody who's going to be a life companion. It could be that if you let go of this ideal of the perfect mate, who, by the way, doesn't exist, right? If you let go of that fantasy, you can open yourself to the reality of somebody who could be great for you, and you could be great for them. That's what I want people to hope for, right? Not the pretend person who's so perfect that he or she doesn't exist and wouldn't marry you anyway if they did, because you're not perfect, right? Let's let go of that and open ourselves to the possibility that a real person with, you know, real strengths and real weaknesses and real foibles and real, you know, fun things about him or her might be right for you, and you might be right for them.
I just love the wisdom of Margaret Kim Peterson. So glad that she's with us today here on Connecting Faith. She's authored a book along with her husband Dwight called Are You Waiting for the One? Cultivating Realistic Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage. One of our other books, it was an earlier work, is called Keeping House, The Litany of Everyday Life. And we're going to transition into talking a little bit about keeping house as we, you know, set that up and keep it going. And we'd love to have you join the conversation. It's 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. We talk more with Margaret Kim Peterson in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, 32 past the hour. And my guest today is Margaret Kim Peterson. Margaret serves as an associate professor of theology at Eastern University at St. David's, PA. Has written several books. The one we've been referencing is called Are You Waiting for the One? Cultivating Realistic Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage. One that I first discovered, Margaret, was her book, Keeping House, The Litany of Everyday Life. And I know, Margaret, in the book about waiting for the one, you talk about hospitality and households, that is, as you said, that's sort of a Christian expectation, a natural expectation of a marriage relationship. But, we live in a world where sort of the idea of housework, in fact, it was kind of interesting. I hadn't, I guess, realized before with this, up until a century or so ago, housework was, it was just work, right? We didn't actually have housework.
Yeah, everybody worked at home. Men worked at home. Women worked at home. That was where life and work were when you live in a society organized around, agrarian household farming and perhaps, craftsmen. And so gender was involved, right? A lot of work was gendered. There was men's work and women's work, but it all took place more or less in the same place, which was around the home or the farm. And it was only with industrialization that a lot of work moved from the home to factories and other workplaces. And what was left behind ended up being called housework. And it was changed a lot by industrialization, too, washing machines and vacuum cleaners and things that made it possible for one woman to do all the work of the household rather than a housewife plus hired help. But that separation of place, with some work out of the house and other work at home, and then the idea that somehow the work that stayed at home, that was women's work and the home was woman's sphere, that's very much an artifact of industrialization.
The subtitle of the book is The Litany of Everyday Life. Talk a little bit about the word litany and how it fits in when we think about housework.
Well, litany is a kind of prayer where you make many petitions and you end each one with a kind of a refrain, like, Lord, have mercy. And it's been a popular form of prayer for centuries and centuries in the church, and especially popular among lay people. It's very accessible, and it allows you to pray for lots of different areas of concern. And if you think about, your life, you realize you've got lots of different areas of concern. So litanies are very flexible, and they let you kind of cover the bases and feel sure that you've, prayed for the things you need to pray for, the people, the concerns, the needs, the thanksgivings, all of those different kinds of things. And I think of I think that the notion of housework as a litany of everyday life is, it fits because housework is about so many different things. And it's usually about a lot of different things without getting into all of them really deeply. Which of us ever has a house that's, like all pieces of it are equally clean at the same time? It doesn't work that way. You you do what you can in the day. You try to cover the bases. You try to get people fed, try to get people clothed, try to get, the house picked up enough that there's somewhere to sit down. And that's enough for the day. And then the next day you do it again. So I think there is that litany-like quality to the work of keeping house that happens every day, doesn't get done, you come back to it again.
Because you prepare a meal and it's gone after a while, and the laundry's washed, but then it's dirty again, right? I mean, it's ongoing, isn't it?
It is. And when you think about God, who makes the sun come up every single morning, it can maybe give a little lift to that that ongoingness. It housework goes on because life goes on. So it's a good thing. It's a good, we relax into our bodies, we relax into our relationships, we relax into time and the way that life is in this world. It's periodic. It's repetitive. It happens again and again. And that's saying housework is never done. That's that it really depends how you see it, how you experience it, whether you see that as something you've kind of been abandoned to or sentenced to, or whether it's an invitation and a gift, an opportunity to step into a dance that's always going, or a prayer that's always going.
We're going to talk a little more about how that dance is inviting and that prayer is welcoming, and we're talking about keeping house. But let's take a couple of calls that are waiting. We'll start with line two. Go ahead. You're on with Margaret Kim Peterson.
Hi, yes. My name is Tiffany, and I have a question about, I am 39, I'll be 40 this year. I have been divorced since 95 and on my own, and I'm trying to become a healthier person because if I do get married again, I want to make sure that it's for life. But my question is, how do you know when you're healthy enough to be in a relationship and to be a good partner?
That is a great question. And one of the things that people who study relationships talk about is the difference between, and you know, let me say, this is one of many possible answers, but one of the things that people who study relationships talk about is the difference between reacting to other people and responding to them. That when you react, it's like your button gets pushed and you just do something. You know, either you're thrilled or you're furious or you run away or you run, you just react. And responding is when you kind of have access to your thoughts and your feelings, and you can think, you know, what kind of a response do I want to make? Do I want to draw closer? Do I want to move farther away? Do I want to ask for more information? As you look at yourself, as any of us looks at ourselves in all our relationships, especially the relationships that we have with members of the family we grew up in, you know, brothers and sisters or parents or any other relatives, when we look at ourselves in the context of those relationships, do we see ourselves reacting more, just like we've got all these buttons and they get pushed? Or do we see ourselves responding more? And the more we respond in the context of our relationships, the more able we are then to make a good choice of partner, to be able to figure out, is this a person I could work well together with? Would we be good mates? Could we build something that lasts? And then actually to, you know, once we've made a good choice, to build something that's strong. So kind of, you know, looking at yourself in that way and saying, am I covered with all sorts of buttons that get pushed and I go off somehow? If that's true, figuring out, you know, what's going on, and working to have sort of more examined and balanced relationships with a whole range of people, I think can give us then the confidence that, as you say, if you do choose to marry again, it can be for life. It can be a healthy and rewarding and positive, growth-filled experience.
I would think, as you've talked about, you know, the support that comes through the body of Christ, that this would certainly be an area where you, some mentoring, some encouragement, some wisdom from someone a little further down the road would be helpful.
Absolutely. And that is a great place to build relationships. One of the best pieces of advice I ever got about relationships was somebody who said, you know, this is a church, you know, person just steeped in Christian faith, former pastor, generation older than myself. And he said that he and his wife had made a point of cultivating friendships with somebody or somebodies in every decade of age above and below themselves. So people in their 80s, 70s, 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s, 20s, teens, children. And because there's so much wisdom and there's so much opportunity to interact in all kinds of different ways out of all kinds of parts of yourself. And I think God really honors that and really illumines that. There's grace given in the context of those different relationships with people in different age groups, different positions in life relative to ourselves. So, you know, looking at, you know, at your relationships in church or your relationships with other Christian people, I think that that's a place where, again, where God can really act and move in ways that, that bring grace and that can bring, again, some confidence in yourself, that yes, you can make a good choice this time.
Let's take another call. Go to line one. Thanks for calling. You're on with Margaret Kim Peterson. Go ahead. Hi, not sure. I don't have the name up on the screen. So call her on line one. Go ahead.
I don't know who's on line one.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's Karen from Lino Lakes.
Hey, Karen,
go ahead.
Okay, that's what I said. I don't know if that's me. I don't know if I'm line one. Hey, I just want to thank you that you're doing this today. I have a group of six young women coming over tonight who a neighbor and I got together with last year once a month to discuss The True Woman by Susan Hunt, the difference between the new woman or the, you know, more the feminist outlook to what God really wants us to be. And this year they asked about taking all those concepts and put them into practical use. So what you're giving me today, I think maybe next month for our gathering we'll re-listen to your program. And do you have anything that we can tell them tonight when we get together?
Well, gosh, I'm not sure what to say. I don't know the book, but I do think that that longing for womanhood is something that is really deep in the heart of every girl and young woman who wants to grow into greater maturity. I think that I think there's a lot of things we could say about feminism, and you know, many of them positive. But I do think that one of the things that's kind of unfortunate in the culture that we live in right now is that there's not, I think, a lot of sense of what it means really to be a woman or really to be a man. There's kind of this androgynous ideal. We're all supposed to be the same. And the thing is, we're not. You know, we're just not. I mean, I have never encountered a young person who wanted to grow up to be kind of, you know, in the middle somewhere. You know, they want to grow up to be true women or true men. And so really thinking, what is it that makes a person womanly and feminine? And what does it mean to want to be a wife and mother or a woman in relationship, and figure out what that means? You know, and again, I don't think it means exactly the same thing for everyone, but I do think that finding a way to relax again into our bodies, to relax into our relationships, our places in our families, coming to terms with our mothers and who our mothers have been, and finding, you know, older Christian women who can say, well, this is how it's been for me. You know, here are things that have been challenges. Here are things that have been rewards. Here's where I've seen grace. I think that's really, really valuable. And so I'm so glad that these six young women have this community with each other and with you to talk about things like that, to be safe to explore it and to open themselves to where God might be leading them.
Now, Margaret, I was thinking, thanks, Karen, for that call, and wish you well here in your ongoing discipleship, and what a great opportunity. But, Margaret, it reminds me, we are very, I guess, intrigued by all the sort of the online services, and it's all sort of about compatibility. You know, you get enough sort of marks together, then you're compatible. I mean, is that something that should we be, making our list and kind of checking it twice?
Well, when I got married, my husband and I were really very different from one another. It turned out that we had moved in similar social circles for a long time, but really hadn't crossed paths with each other. And when we did get to know one another and did decide that we wanted to get married, our friends were just astounded because they thought of us as so different. They just couldn't imagine us together. And we thought, well, all right. So now I've had 15 and a half years to think about, well, why was this a good choice? And I've realized that we were different in terms of style. You know, he's much more outgoing than I am, you know, that kind of thing, and different in the kinds of histories that we have with our families. But in terms of kind of basic conviction and how, you know, the importance of church and faith in our lives, the importance of, you know, integrity, of being trustworthy, of, you know, valuing home, valuing kids, you know, wanting the same sort of style of life, to be, you know, basically comfortable financially, but not wealthy, and that's okay, so nobody gets in trouble for not earning more money than he does, you know, that kind of thing. You know, my husband doesn't get in trouble for not, you know, doing something more fancy than being a college professor, and I don't get into trouble for working only half-time so that I can have time at home. That's okay, because we can be satisfied there. That kind of compatibility, I think, really, that's really important. Those are important conversations to have. What do you want out of life? What's important to you? You know, can you supply the different parts of the equation of what it means to build a healthy home and family? So, you know, I'm not sold on the, well, you have to have identical personalities kind of thing. You know, there some difference can spice things up. Although even there, that, you know, that's been a challenge for us, really to value each other's differences as complementary strengths. Right, that's a challenge. And the more different you are, the more you really have to both kind of step back and look at what's going on, and then step toward each other and say, how can we value each other? How can we see this not as I'm right and you're wrong, or you have a better way of being than I do, but what do you do well? What's wonderful about you? What do I do well? What's wonderful about me?
You know, one of the chapters in your book, Are You Waiting for the One? You talked about peace, which mm-hmm. You know, as I kind of looked at that, well, that's probably pretty appropriate, because there's going to be some conflict along the way.
Oh, there always is, because people are different from each other. And peace is something you have to make actively. And, you know, it's not just absence of conflict. You know, absence of conflict is what you get when you sort of go in other rooms and different, you know, separate rooms and watch TV by yourself. And, you know, who wants that? You know, we want community in marriage. And if you peaceable community, you have to build, and it's great. You know, it's a lot of work, and it's really, really worth it.
I was thinking probably, you know, all the guys are saying, that doesn't sound too bad to me, but so you were kind of speaking from a woman's perspective maybe there. But
well, you know,
here's
something I've heard said, women want to talk more, men want to fight less.
Okay.
So how can we find a way where we talk more and we fight less? Where talking is a way, you know, if when he talks with her, she feels better and he feels like $1 million because, look, he's made his wife feel good, right? Guys want to do that. They want to be seen as the guy who helps, right? And women want somebody who will listen to them, who will take them seriously, who will, you know, step up to the plate and be part of the solution. You know, that I really think there are lots of ways for men and women to get together what they both want in their own different ways. And they, you know, guys don't have to try to be like women, right? A woman doesn't want a man who's like a woman. A woman wants a man. She wants a man in relationship. And my guess is that's what guys want too. They might experience it differently or ask for it differently, but. You know, men want to fight less. Women want to talk more.
Well, we're going to talk more with Margaret Kim Peterson because we love talking with Margaret. She's got great insights. She serves as an associate professor of theology at Eastern University at St. David's, Pennsylvania. And she's authored several books. The one that we've been referencing that she co-wrote with her husband, Dwight, called Are You Waiting for the One? Cultivating Realistic Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage. And another one that we've been talking about as well called Keeping House, The Litany of Everyday Life. And we're going to get to that kind of circle back to that in just a moment as well. Glad to have you part of the broadcast. You can join us with a call or comment at 877-933-2484. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We're connecting today with Margaret Kim Peterson, and we're talking about a couple of the books that she's written, one that she co-wrote with her husband Dwight called Are You Waiting for the One? Cultivating Realistic Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage. A good insight here just in time for Valentine's Day. The other one we're referencing is called Keeping House, The Litany of Everyday Life. And it is kind of interesting that we've got all these labor-saving appliances, and yet it seems like no one has time to cook or, you know, care for the home or any of those things. Have we devalued keeping house we just don't have time for it? We don't put a high enough priority in it?
Well, I think, again, we have to take seriously kind of the social environment that we live in, and especially in today's economy. You know, people need to be working. Anybody who can be working wants to work. And often, the day has passed when, you know, a couple generations ago, one salary could adequately support a family. Now most families need two salaries just to get by. And if both adults are out working all the time, you know, who's going to do the housework? You know, it ends up being just too great a burden for one person to do. And, you know, if one person is doing it, it's often a wife. That's kind of just traditionally the default pattern that people fall into, even if they don't want to. And then it ends up being just a gigantic burden. I think that, you know, one of the things we talk about in our book, Are We Waiting for the One? And I can't remember whether I talked about it very much in The Litany of Everyday Life, is we think it's important, I think it's important, for husbands and wives to share the work of making a home. And it's not because, you know, somehow there's this egalitarian rule out there that says you have to split all the chores down the middle. But most husbands and wives do work outside the home. And this is their chance to do something together, to have a joint project, something they build in a way that really brings them together intentionally to provide for one another and for their children the things that we all need in order to be comfortable in our bodies and comfortable in our relationships. You know, shared meals, clean clothes, a pleasant place to live, you know, pleasant enough, good enough, you know, within the limits of our time and our income. And that, you know, just to say, oh, we don't have time, I think we have to pull back and say, well, why don't we have time? Is it because we've devalued it, that we think that somehow this doesn't really count as important work? Or is it that we truly are really, really busy, a lot of hours just trying to make ends meet financially? How can we kind of have pity on each other as husbands and wives and parents of children so that we say together, yes, meals are important. Yes, nurturance is important. Yes, time spent together is important. And then pull together to have home be a place where there is some rest and there is some refreshment and there is some care, because those things really matter.
Yeah, you know, for someone that well, I guess, you know, busy families or, you know, even singles as well, you're just going, you know, just keeping up with it. How do we, I guess, understand that it is important work, maybe some of the most important work that we can do, when it doesn't feel like you know, there's much reward or joy in it. I was thinking of a young mom, you know, it's just, and it's just picking up constantly, and, you know, it's just laundry and whatever it might be. How do we, I guess, maybe step back and see the importance, and is there a biblical perspective that would help us?
You know, I think one of the things any mom, especially if the way that things are set up in the home is kids are young, mom is mostly responsible, maybe she's at home all the time, maybe she's out part of, you know, working part of full time, but she's, you know, she's got a lot of responsibility for the young kids. One of the number one things she needs is a husband who really gets it, you know, who really sees how much she does, who really values it, who really wants to make sure that she gets some time for herself, that she gets some nurturance from him, that she gets some, you know, that they find a way for there to be some support, some sharing with another family or, you know, with a, you know, a grandmother or somebody. Just knowing that what you do and the sacrifices that you're making for your family are seen and valued every day, that goes a long, long way toward refreshing a mom's heart and helping her feel like, yeah, this is a lot of work, but it's really worth it. I think that's a big thing. And then I think finding ways, you know, genuinely to share some of the work. You know, one of the ways that you can show that you think it's really, it really matters that whatever the job is gets done at home is to offer to help with it or to take it on as your own responsibility. And different husbands and wives are going to work this out in different ways. I don't think there's one right way. But behaving ourselves as if we really value the work and we really value the worker and we notice when things get done and we notice when things need to be done and we do them. And then when we notice that somebody else did it, we say thank you. I just think that's getting into those kinds of habits is really worth the trouble.
Is there a, maybe part of the household, the keeping house in your life that you don't necessarily enjoy doing, but you do? Or have you been able to sort of maybe make it into a prayer or a litany?
Cleaning is just not my thing. You know, tidying, picking up, organizing, I'm happy to do that. But the actual cleaning part of it, oh, my gosh. I mean, the tolerance that I have for drifts of dog hair blowing around the floor is just amazing. And in our home, you know, my husband is handicapped, uses a wheelchair. There's a real limit to what he can do around the house. One of the things that he has always done, he's always made more money than I have, and he's always done the books. He's taken care of the finances, which is great, and I say thank you, you know, every time he balances that checkbook. But I don't look to him to help with some of these other chores, including, yeah, I guess, you know, in some sort of perfect world, if I didn't like to clean, I'd have a husband who did like to, or who was at least willing to do it. And in my household, that just can't happen. You know, either the house gets cleaned by me, or it gets cleaned by somebody else who gets paid to come in, or it doesn't get cleaned. And we've kind of done all of those at different times in our lives. And, you know, that's nobody's going to like all aspects of keeping house equally. Nobody. You know, I have friends who really don't like to cook, you know, friends who really don't, you know, do whatever else it is. And that's fine. You know, it's okay to have limits and challenges. And maybe our mates can pick up the slack there and maybe they can't. Maybe, you know, maybe that's just going to be something that's never done, you know, terrifically well, quote unquote, in our household. And good enough is just going to have to be good enough.
Do you find any encouragement from maybe a, you know, biblical perspective or, you know, reading about Mary and Martha or those things?
I do. One of the things I find really encouraging from a biblical perspective, you say how much time and effort God seems to give to making the sun come up every morning and to feeding people and to clothing people and to sheltering people. And, you know, you see this in descriptions of God in the Old Testament. You see it in stories told about Jesus in the New Testament. These are things that matter to God and that God is willing to get his own hands dirty with. And you know, even the priests of the Old Covenant, you know, they spent a lot of time keeping house in the tabernacle. And so I really do feel like God gets it. You know, he understands this. And, you know, when Jesus says that you know, among the people who come into the kingdom are those who fed the hungry and clothed the naked and cared for the sick, visited the prisoners, you know, insofar as you did it unto the least of these, my brethren, you did it unto me. And that makes me feel like God really cares about this work. He sees it. He cares about it. I think that, you know, the story of Mary and Martha is a really interesting one. There's a story right before that in the Gospel of Luke where a man says to Jesus, you know, I want to come and follow you, but quick, I have to, I, you know, I guess Jesus says, come follow me. And the man says, I have to bury my father. And Jesus says, oh, let the dead bury their own dead. You come and follow me. And then there's the story of Mary and Martha where Martha complains about Mary who's, you know, sitting at the Lord's feet. And Jesus says to Martha, you know, Mary's chosen the better part. And it's really interesting how when biblical scholars look at those stories, they think, well, clearly Martha just, you know, she's worried too much about the food. She should chill out, order pizza or something, I guess they think she ought to do. But they look at the guy who wants to bury his father, and they think, oh, my gosh, he can't possibly neglect that. You know, they seem to think he wants to do something important, but Martha wants to do something unimportant. And I think Jesus is saying these things are that you think are so important, they're relative to loving me and caring for me. They're relative to being in relationship with me. And so, you know, keeping house is important. And Martha thought it was important, and she was doing an important thing. She was showing hospitality to God in the flesh, no less. And relationship with God comes first, and relationship with people comes first. And yet we live that out through our service, including service in feeding and clothing and sheltering. So I think it's complex and paradoxical. And so when I feel sort of caught in housework and not unambiguously happy about doing it, which is, you know, sometimes, that's important to remember. It's okay. It's okay to feel the paradox.
Margaret, it's always good to visit with you. Our time is gone. It's been a great hour, and I want to just recommend her writings, Keeping House, The Litany of Everyday Life, and then also Are You Waiting for the One? Cultivating Realistic Positive Expectations for Christian Marriage. Margaret Kim Peterson, Associate Professor of Theology at Eastern University, and our guest here on Connecting Faith. Margaret, blessings to you. Thanks so much, and greetings to Dwight as well.
I will convey those. It's always so good to talk with you.
Margaret Kim Peterson joining us today on Connecting Faith, and I want to just remind you to check out the podcast, maybe pass it on to a friend or listen to it while you're keeping house. I don't know. Thanks for listening to Connecting Faith.